Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I'm Matthew Gage. This is lesson number 12 in the book of Acts. We'll be in Acts chapter 9, verses 1 through 25 today. And the title of today's lesson is The Conversion of Saul. The conversion of Saul of Tarsus is really a pivotal moment in human history, because this man is literally going to turn the world upside down through his teaching, through his preaching, through his writing. He is going to carry the gospel throughout the Roman world. His writings are going to define Christian doctrine. And, you know, would it not be for Paul? You know, Christianity may have just remained an offshoot sect of Judaism, but Paul took the gospel to the entire world and helped really define what Christianity is and how it should be practiced. Now, it's very interesting because, I mean, Saul of Tarsus was one of the of Christianity's fiercest opponents. In the early days, I mean, to the point of throwing people in prison, just a very, very much a hater of Christianity. And yet he's going to become his chiefest spokesman and really define what Christianity is. The course of the Roman Empire and even European civilization is never going to be the same after the ministry of Paul. And by the way, notice I keep slipping in between Saul and Paul. Saul and Paul, they're the same guy. He changes his name later on. But so if I slip up and keep calling him, it's the same guy. I just keep, you know, doing that. It's kind of hard to keep him straight and not do that. The setting for our story is Damascus. It's, you know, up north of Israel, up in Syria. Supposedly, it's the oldest continually inhabited city in the world. I mean, it has evidence of being settled and a community being there. I mean, thousands and thousands of years before Christ. So, very interesting. I mean, even Greek times and Roman times and even under, you know, Muslim control and even today, I mean, it's still a thriving metropolis. Now, this takes place somewhere between 34 and 36 AD. We're not really sure. We can kind of help to date it, by the way. Let's see here. I don't have the reference here. But when Paul tells the story, I think, three or four times. And one of the times he talks about him when he escaped Damascus, he was escaping King Aretas. Well, King Aretas of Nabatea, and here we go getting historical again. But King Aretas actually gained control of Damascus somewhere around 37 AD, according to historical and archaeological records. Not sure exactly, but there is a coin that dates it to 37 AD. So it's, you know, so his escape from Damascus probably takes place somewhere around 37 AD, but, you know, can't be sure. And it honestly could be earlier than that. That's just the first thing we can actually place a solid date on it. So most of this would have to take place before then. But, you know, just kind of conjecturing that it takes place somewhere between 34 and 36 AD. So let's get started. Verse 1, and Saul, yet breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, went unto the high priest, verse 2, and desired of him letters to Damascus, to the synagogues, that if he found any of this way, whether they were men or women, he might bring them bound unto Jerusalem. So here's Saul's mission. He is out to squash Christianity, and evidently he's been a chief persecutor throughout, you know, Judea and Samaria and, you know, right there around Israel. And now he's really wanting to branch out. He's got reports that there's believers at Damascus and evidently, you know, been troubling the synagogue up there. So he wants to go up there and squash this. Let's, you know, keep it contained, you know, to just right there around Israel. So, you know, keep this movement contained. So he wants to go up there. He gets permission from the high priest, gets the authority. So when he goes up there, you know, they see he's coming directly from Jerusalem, from the high authority, and has authority to do what he's doing. And very interesting, he talks about find any of this way. Some historians believe that one of the early terms for Christianity was simply the way. And perhaps this is a reference to that. Some people think that it actually talks about, you know, that, you know, always just if he found anybody going that way as he was on his way to Damascus. But there's actually pretty good historical evidence that he's actually talking about finding anyone who was Christians, that they were actually called the way, you know, based on Christ saying, I am the way, the truth, and the life. In fact, even my Scofield Bible I have here, it's one of the newer updated ones with the notes, but even the little marginal note talks about they that were of the way, with a capital W. So very likely he's referring back to John 14:6, by the way. But there is some historical evidence for that, and honestly, it makes a lot of sense to me that they would do that. So he's going to go up there. He's going to arrest these men and women, bring them bound, arrest them as if they're criminals, bring them back to Jerusalem for trial to be dealt with. Verse number 3. And as he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly there shined round about him a light from heaven. So something miraculous is going to happen here. Saul of Tarsus is on his way to persecute the church. He's almost to Damascus, you know, I don't know, maybe a dozen miles, maybe just right outside the city. We don't really know. I don't believe. Let me see here. Does it talk about? No, it doesn't. I was about to say, for some reason, I was thinking maybe it talked about how many days' journey they were later on. But anyway, he's getting close to Damascus as he's riding along on his horse or camel, probably horse. As he's riding along, a great light shines down from heaven. It's the middle of the day, yet there's this brilliant light that shines down, so brilliant. I mean, as he's shrinks down away from it, he's thrown from his horse. The people, his companions, actually see the light too. They also are very startled because of this. I mean, this is something, listen, this doesn't happen. A bright light in the middle of the day, bright enough to blind you and knock you off your horse, that does not happen. This is something miraculous God is going to do to get Saul's attention. Verse 4, and he fell to the earth and heard a voice saying unto him, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? So this is Jesus Christ that's speaking to him. We will see later. He points directly to Saul, you know, calls him by name and wants to know, why in the world are you persecuting me? You know, he wasn't persecuting the church. He was persecuting God. He was persecuting the Messiah. He was persecuting Jesus Christ. In going after God's children, he was going after God himself. So notice there, you know, he's saying, look, you're persecuting me. You're not persecuting my people. It's personal. You're persecuting me. When you mess with God's children, you're messing with God himself. Verse 5, and he, that's Saul, said, who art thou, Lord? Now, I think this is hilarious. He says, who art thou, Lord? So it's like, who are you? But you're the Lord. So it wants to know who he is, and then he says who he is. It says he's the Lord. So very funny there, I think. And the Lord said, I am Jesus, whom thou persecutest. It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks. So Jesus identifies himself and then says it's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. Now, this is a reference back to plowing, of all things. When they would plow, they didn't have, you know, donkeys and stuff necessarily plowing. Usually they would use oxen. That was the biggest, strongest beast that they had. So, which oxen, by the way, is just kind of like a big steer, you know, a large bovine animal that's been castrated. I think that's two lessons in a row. I've used the word castrated. That's very rare. You don't use that word very often. So it's not just a breed. It's actually, it's a steer, to use modern, you know, less graphic terms. And You tie the plow, you know, have the harness, have the plow tied onto them, and they would pull the plow through the ground. You'd stand back there and help guide the plow. And they didn't use a whip or throw rocks necessarily to move the animal, because if you whipped, it would scare them, it'd spook them, they'd take off. You didn't want to do that. You know, I could see them throwing pebbles at them to keep them going. Listen, you know, I grew up on a dairy farm. Sometimes to get the cows up to milking, I'd pick up a handful of rocks and I'd throw a rock at them to kind of hurry them along. But what they did, actually, they'd have something called an ox goad, and basically just a big, long, maybe 10-foot-long stick that was pointy at the end. There's nothing as fearsome in this world as a pointy stick. So they'd take this stick and they would poke them, and you know, just to get them moving along. And you know, a ox that was a little bit stubborn or rebellious, it would kick every time they'd feel that. Instead of get going, they'd kick back at it. And what Jesus is saying is, basically what Jesus is saying here is that, Saul, I've been trying to get your attention, I've been pricking your conscience, and yet you keep resisting me. So basically what we have here is a glimpse of what's really been going inside of Saul of Tarsus. Even though he has been the chiefest persecutor and lashing out against Christianity, inside of his heart and mind has been a struggle as you know, the Holy Spirit has been convicting him and drawing him to believe in Christ. So throughout all this time, as he's been persecuting, perhaps even as far back or even before the death of Stephen, he has wrestled with this. Verse 6, and he, trembling and astonished, said, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? So, you know, he's at his end. He's, you know, look, Lord, I'll do anything. What do you want me to do? And the Lord said unto him, arise and go into the city, and it shall be told thee what thou must do. So God says, just go ahead, you know, await further orders. I'll let you know when you get there. So verse 7, and the men which journeyed with him stood speechless, hearing a voice, but seeing no man. Now, with the other passages, it seems like that they were able to hear something, but not necessarily make out what's going on. If you compare it to Acts 22:9 and verse 20 and chapter 26, verse 14, when Paul retells the story, they were able to hear a voice, but not make it out. I don't know if the best way I can think of to illustrate this, if you've ever had a radio playing in one part of your house and you're in the other part of the house and you can hear the music, but you can't quite make out what the song is. Have you ever done that? In fact, sometimes you'll think you know what the song is and you kind of get that song going in your head. Then you walk in there and realize it's not even that song. It's a totally different song, but just something about it made you think it was a totally different song. Well, these people were able to hear something. They were able to hear, you know, a voice. They knew it was a voice. It wasn't thunder. It wasn't, you know, a cat. It, you know, this was a voice. They just couldn't make out what it was. You know, maybe it sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher. Another pop culture reference. Sorry. They slip out every now and then. So anyway, so they hear this voice and, you know, but they don't understand what it is. So verse 8. And Saul arose from the earth, and when his eyes were open, he saw no man. So it's not that no men were there, he just could not see. He was blinded. But they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. So they get him there, they find him a place to stay, and trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. Can you imagine the little bit of stir that's going on there? He's got papers to persecute the church, and yet this miraculous thing happens to him. I can imagine the gossip going around town, like, did you hear Saul of Tarsus here? But did you hear what happened to him? So he's there, verse number 9, and he was 3 days without sight, and neither did eat nor drink. So he's really struggling. I can just imagine the inner turmoil going on inside the heart and mind of Saul of Tarsus as he's wrestling with this. You know, his strict Judaistic training. He was a Pharisee of the highest, strictest order, and here he is. You know, this man that he was taught to hate and to deny. Here he is realizing that this man truly is God, and Just imagine the turmoil going in, the debate that's raging in his mind as he's struggling with this. And so that leads us to the next section here, beginning in verse 10. We're going to deal with the disciple named Ananias. Now, poor Ananias, I wish we gave him a lot more credit, because he really is a remarkable individual. For this brief passage, we get to get a glimpse of this man. Must have been a very remarkable a man. He ought to be a hero of the faith, yet we just kind of gloss over him. Verse 10, and there was a certain disciple at Damascus named Ananias. And to him said the Lord in a vision, Ananias. And he said, behold, I am here, Lord. Verse 11, and the Lord said unto him, arise, and go into the street which is called Straight, and inquire in the house of Judas for one called Saul of Tarsus, for behold, he prayeth. Now, let me give you a historical side note right here real quick. The street which is called Straight. It is there. There is a street, a Roman-built street. I don't think it dates back to the Greek times, but I believe it's Roman, that actually goes through the middle of the old Damascus, east to west. It's a straight street passing through there. Why was that important? Because Damascus was on the trade routes, so the traders could come passing through there. And this street was actually a major commercial street. That's something even we do nowadays. You ever notice you get up on a highway and you look on both sides and you got Walmarts and Home Depots and Chick-fil-A's and, Pizza Huts, and all the shops and stores all seem to be, right down one main road. I know there used to be a place down in Fort Worth they used to call Restaurant Row, because that's where all the restaurants were, right down this road. And but anyway, the straight street was like that. This is where the marketplace was. There's a lot of traders, but it was built so the caravans could pass through the town safely and, could trade along the way. So that is there. You can look up. There's pictures and stuff of it. They actually still, use not necessarily the Roman street, but that same street idea is actually still incorporated into Damascus. And tells him to go find the house of Judas that's on that street. And then he breaks the news to poor Ananias. Says, this is the reason why I want you to go there, because Saul of Tarsus, he's praying. And Ananias right there, oh, Lord, yeah, I'll do whatever. Yeah, okay, great. The straight street. Yeah, no problem. House of Judas. Okay, got it. Wait, Saul of Tarsus? Did I hear you right, Lord? Saul of Tarsus, the guy who's persecuting us, you want me to go talk to him? Verse 12, and have seen a vision. This is God still talking. In a vision, a man named Ananias coming in and putting his hand on him that he might receive his sight. So this is what Ananias is supposed to do. He's supposed to go there, go find Saul, put his hand on him, pray for him, and he's going to receive his sight again. So verse 13, Ananias answered, Lord, I have heard by many of this man how much evil he hath done to thy saints at Jerusalem. And verse 14, and here he hath authority from the chief priest to bind all that call on thy name. So he's like, God, excuse me, are you sure we're talking about the same guy? I mean, can you imagine this? God calls you in the middle of the night and says, hey, I want you to go to Afghanistan and go talk to Osama bin Laden. Wait a minute, Lord. He wants to kill people like me. That's similar, maybe a lot more extreme and far-fetched, but that's kind of similar to what's going on here. Is he saying, God, are you thinking right here? This guy can arrest me, take me back to Jerusalem. He hates Christians. You really want me to go see him? So verse 15, but the Lord said to him, go thy way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. Verse 16, for I must show him how great things he must suffer for my name's sake. So God just tells Ananias, look, I've got great things planned for Saul of Tarsus. You don't understand. You're looking at it very short-sighted here. He's going to be a wonderful instrument that I am going to use. And, to preach the name of Christ before Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. It's like, look, Ananias, just go do it. Trust me. I've got big things planned for Saul of Tarsus. So, why do I consider Ananias to be a hero of the faith? Because he actually went and talked to Saul of Tarsus. I'm not sure I would have the guts to do that. If God would you know, woke me up in the middle of the night and says, hey, I want you to go talk to Richard Dawkins, that British man that, that hates Christianity, that's authored all kinds of books against, you know, against God and promoting atheism and evolution. I want you to go talk to him. Like, God, are you sure? But even that doesn't convey, you know, the magnitude of this, because Richard Dawkins can't have me arrested. I mean, also, the closest thing I can think of is, you know, if God calls and tells you to go talk to Osama bin Laden, because he can kill you and probably would. So, I mean, can you imagine just how dramatic this was, this thing that they, that God wanted Ananias to do, yet he went and did it. He obeyed the Lord in spite of the danger he felt he was facing and really was facing. He still obeyed God. And because of this small thing that Ananias was able to, I mean, it's small in comparison to maybe this other things, but because of his obedience in this matter, Saul is going to become Paul. Saul is going to become the Paul the Apostle. He's going to be able to preach the gospel and write the books of the Bible. What if Ananias had said no? What if he hadn't obeyed? What if Saul had just fallen by the wayside? But in part, Ananias had a small part in helping bring Saul into Christianity, and so he could become Paul the Apostle. So, verse number 17, and Ananias went his way and entered into the house, and putting his hands on him, said, Brother Saul. So I like this. He immediately calls him brother, too. He's not, you know, Saul, hey, Mr. Saul. It's actually brother. So he's already acknowledging that he's one of the fold that he's believed. So Brother Saul, the Lord, even Jesus, that appeared unto thee in the way as thou camest, hath sent me, that thou mightest receive thy sight and be filled with the Holy Ghost. Now, it's interesting. How did he know that Jesus had appeared to him? Maybe the rumor got around. Maybe God had revealed it to him. I don't know. But so he says, you know, he says, look, he sent me so you receive your sight and receive the Holy Ghost. Verse number 18. And immediately there fell from his eyes as it had been scales, and he received sight forthwith and arose and was baptized. So Ananias prays for him, lays his hands on, prays for him, and immediately Saul can see again. So evidently that's going to get my attention too. You know, if somebody can pray for me and cause me to have my sight, and right there, hey, I'll listen to just about anything else you have to say. And Saul right there, you know, that's just another sign of God working on Saul, saying, look, don't argue with me. I can give you your sight. I can take it away. Don't argue with me, son. So immediately, he receives a sight, he's baptized, so he is now in the church, one of the believers. So what does he do? Let's see what Saul, the Christian, begins to do. Verse 20, and straightway he preached Christ in the synagogues that he is the Son of God. Can you imagine? Word's already gotten around that this guy has the authority. He's there to arrest Christians. They heard something weird happened on the road, and next Saturday on the Sabbath he goes to the synagogue. I can see the rulers of the synagogue there, like, oh, good, Saul's here. Yeah, we got these letters. Saul, why don't you rise up and speak? You know, yeah, really rip those Christians, Saul. Saul gets up, and instead of ripping the Christians, he says, folks, let me tell you something. Let me talk to you about Jesus Christ. And everybody's thinking, yeah, Saul, you get him. You rip up that Jesus. We don't like him. And instead of ripping Jesus, he starts proving that Jesus is the Messiah, that Jesus is God. Can you imagine the look on everybody's face like, wait a minute, what's going on here? Is this the same Saul? What's going on here? Verse 21, and all that heard him were amazed. Yes, I would have been amazed too. And said, is not this he that destroyed them which called on this name in Jerusalem and came hither for that intent that he might bring them bound to the chief priests? Like, is this the same guy that we've been talking about? So verse 22, but Saul increased the more in strength and confounded the Jews which dwelt at Damascus, proving that this is very Christ. Saul, we know from his writings, especially the book of Romans, that Saul was a brilliant orator and debater. He was a very brilliant man, highly trained, knew the scriptures, you know, backwards and forwards and sideways and any which way. Saul had a brilliant mind. In fact, they say that I've read that lawyers used to actually study his logic in the in the book of Romans and how he presented arguments, because it is so effective. And here he is using his vast knowledge of the scripture and training to prove that Jesus was the Christ. And it says he confounded the Jews. They were left without any type of defense, without any type of excuse. They could not even debate the man. They couldn't dispute what he was saying. And it talks about proving that this is very Christ. It's proving that Jesus was Christ. They're proving that Jesus was who he said he was. Okay, so he's up there. He's creating a stir. He's really got things stirred up. So what's going to happen now? Of course, the Jewish rulers cannot let that stand. Verse 23. And after that, many days were fulfilled. The Jews took counsel to kill him. So we've got to do something about this guy. Let's kill him. Verse 24, but their laying await was known of Saul, and they watched the gates day and night to kill him. So Saul knew that they wanted to kill him. He needed to get out of town before they caught him, and they had guards at the gates. Damascus was a walled city. Basically, the only way in and out is through the gates. So they had guys stationed all the gates looking for Saul of Tarsus, because as soon as he got out, they wanted to kill him. And verse number 25, then the disciples took him by night and let him down by the wall in a basket. So they actually went to the wall, found a place, you know, maybe it's 20, 30 feet up. I don't know. Probably was. And they get a large basket. And I've heard people say, well, they didn't make baskets that big. Yeah, they had baskets that big. And a full-grown man back in those days, well, he wasn't 6'5 and weighed 260. Saul and Jews, and even people in general back then, were, you know, maybe 5'4", 5'6", weigh 120 pounds. I mean, that's kind of average. People were very much smaller back then on average. Very poor nutrition and such, and different reasons for that. But they actually were a lot smaller of stature. So he's not a very big man. So listen, people, I saw, as I was researching this, I saw all kinds of skeptic websites that were bashing this. Why did they couldn't let him down a basket? They didn't make baskets that big. Man, I see baskets all the time that are that big. We got a clothes hamper right now that's a basket and it's that big, you know. And so I know a lot of times ancient stuff is very much smaller, but even still, they had baskets that big to store stuff in. You know, that's absurd. There's all kinds of reliefs on walls that shows people having baskets full of grain that are that size. So that's just a bunch of lies. So they took them, tie a rope to it, and like, well, they didn't have rope. Oh, they had rope. You know, come on. It's just people looking for some kind of crazy off the wall story in the Bible to bash. And of all the crazy stories in the Bible to bash, this is probably one of the worst ones to pick, because this could easily happen. Even if it wasn't a basket big enough to put the man in, maybe it's a basket big enough for him to put his feet in and tied to, so, you know, he can hold on to the rope as they let him down. You know, I don't know. I wish I knew a little bit more about this, but it, basically Saul was so effective at preaching the gospel and in arguing Christianity before the Jews, he had to be killed. He had to be done with. The Jews had to get rid of this man. And so to the point, he has to escape town. It's a good thing he did. Listen, let's say, what would have happened had Saul actually been captured and killed? You know, who would have wrote Romans and Galatians? Who would have preached the gospel to Thessalonica and Corinth and the many other places throughout the empire? Who would have done it? God, in his marvelous grace, not only picked Saul of Tarsus and not only went down and really broke a lot of standard procedure to do so, get the gospel to him so that he would be converted, and really gave him power and gave him a lot of just even natural talents and abilities and gifts. That same grace of God made sure that he stayed safe even at this early hour. Now, you look at the ministry of Paul, and this is pretty minor. Just having somebody wanting to kill him, and he has to escape by being let down by a basket over the wall. You know, listen, some of the other stuff between the shipwrecks and the beatings and the stoning, this is pretty minor stuff, but it really just kind of, really this sets the stage. This is the same type of pattern we see with Paul. Everywhere he goes, he's going to preach Christ. He is super effective at doing so. There's opposition to him, whether from the Jews or the Romans or, you know, the pagans, and he has to escape or get out of there or face that persecution. So we see this play out time and time again in the ministry of Paul. So now where does Paul go? He's going to go to Jerusalem from here. We're going to deal with that next time. Paul still has a lot to learn. Now, he's a very gifted man, and we know he's a very zealous man, but he still has a lot to learn. And I think part of what he has to learn, maybe he has to learn to back down a little bit. Maybe he is so pushy. And I think it's the same thing perhaps Stephen had that he was fighting with, was just perhaps they were just too pointed in what they said. They had to learn to, and Saul had to learn to dial it back a little bit because they wanted to kill this man. It wasn't just that they, you know, like, well, we'll ignore him. Well, we'll kick him out of there. We have to kill this man. So it's either he was that effective or perhaps he was just a little bit too pointed and pushed a little bit too hard. It could be. So anyway, I will quit rambling. Very important chapter. Acts chapter 9 is a critical moment in the book of Acts. The conversion of Saul, let's say, here in a little bit, Saul is going to take over the book of Acts. Paul's missions, Paul's journeys basically become the book of Acts here in just a couple of chapters. But we're not through with everybody else. In fact, we're going to be shift back into Peter here by the end of this chapter. And then in the next lesson we'll deal with that. Then after that we'll deal with the conversion of Cornelius, and we'll have the gospel open to the Gentiles. And eventually here, let's see here, we'll finally get to, I guess, chapter 13, and we'll deal with the ministry of Paul. And he'll pop up a little bit here every now and then, but he's going to spend some time just to really get things straight in his own mind, to really understand and fully grasp Christianity. He's going to have to spend some time to get some things straight in his own mind. So anyway, we'll wrap up the lesson there. It's a watershed moment in history, the conversion of Paul. I hope you've enjoyed it. I know I don't have a lot of very dramatic historical stuff I like to throw in, and I haven't really gone off on tangents and preached a lot in this one. It's a very, very, very familiar story, and very straightforward, though, also. So not a lot I can add to the gospel narrative here other than just point out what amazing things are going to happen because of what's happened in this lesson. So anyway, I appreciate you listening. Hope to catch you next time. If you enjoyed the lesson, check out more at BaptistBasics.org. Click on the Baptist Basics University tab, BBU tab up there. We'll listen to some sermons. Click on downloads. Got some sermons. Got some different piano recordings I've done. And check out the articles there. Be on the lookout for more lessons, more podcasts, and catch up with them on iTunes. Just a lot of great things. A lot of stuff I really hope to get going. I spoke a little bit of that in the previous lesson, but a lot of stuff I really hope to branch out and be able to do a little bit more, especially with the podcast coming up, hopefully very soon. So anyway, I appreciate you listening. Hope it's been a help and a blessing to you. I'm Matthew Gage, and thank you for listening.